From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Armistead Maupin is a novelist and gay activist living in San Francisco. On today's edition of Fresh Air, Maupin discusses how his life and the lives of his straight and gay characters have changed since the mid-70s when he started his series of humorous novels, Tales of the City. Also today, a 75-cent accounting discrepancy led computer expert Clifford Stoll to break a computer spy ring. We find out how he tracked the hackers down. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a never-before-recorded opera by Kurt Weill. And critic Maureen Corrigan reviews The Reader's Catalog. It has information on 40,000 books and an 800 number to order them. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Bill Redlin. Florida state lawmakers are on their way home, anti-abortion activists are licking their wounds, and abortion rights activists have been buoyed by the legislature's rejection of all attempts to restrict access to abortion in the state. Governor Bob Martinez called the session, but he and his supporters failed to get a single bill out of committee. The special session adjourned today after only one day of meetings. In a dramatic turn around from past votes, the U.S. House of Representatives decided today to permit federal funding for abortions in pregnancies caused by rape or incest. NPR's Cokie Roberts reports the vote is seen as a recognition of new political realities.
Since 1981, Congress has restricted federally funded abortions only to those deemed necessary to save the life of the mother. Though the Senate has regularly added funding for cases of rape and incest, the House has insisted on removing those categories, and the House has won. But today the tables turned. After a heated debate where many of the 27 Congresswomen rose to ask their colleagues to extend federal funding, the House reversed its position. The vote came in the context of a shifting political scene. Until the Supreme Court decision in the Webster case last summer, most members of Congress believed they could only get in political trouble by supporting abortion rights. But the outpouring from supporters of those rights in the wake of the Supreme Court decision has changed that political calculation. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
President Bush has told Italy's president the United States is concerned about an Italian company that is suspected of selling the Soviet Union technology used to build a supersonic jet fighter. Mr. Bush and Francesco Cossiga met at the White House today. Cossiga told the president the investigation into the allegations against the Olivetti company were being pursued in a highly cooperative manner, according to Assistant Secretary of State Raymond Seitz. On another subject, the two leaders agreed the West should back efforts for democratic changes in Eastern Europe with financial support. Congress will consider a bill that extends political asylum to refugees from El Salvador, Nicaragua, and China. NPR's Richard Gonzalez has more.
For 6 years, Congressman Joe Moakley, a Massachusetts Democrat, has been trying to win legal status for El Salvadoran refugees. That move was opposed by the Reagan administration. 2 years ago, Moakley added Nicaraguan refugees to his proposal. This year, Moakley thinks he has finally found a way for winning congressional approval for his refugee bill. He is proposing to include the 77,000 Chinese currently working or studying here in the U.S. His bill would grant refugees from Nicaragua, El Salvador, and China 3 years of asylum and work authorization papers. In order to benefit from the plan, the refugees would be required to register with the Immigration Service and pay income taxes. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
And a statement from the East German Politburo today says the leadership there is willing to talk about possible reforms in the country. This is NPR News. United Nations Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar is welcoming the planned release of 7 South African political prisoners, but the president of the General Assembly says while the move is welcome, it is too late and too little. South Africa announced yesterday it will free Walter Sisulu and other leaders of the African National Congress, but not Nelson Mandela. The UN Secretary General said indications that South Africa is seeking political change are encouraging, but he noted many other leaders representing the majority of South Africans are still imprisoned. The Executive Committee of UNESCO, the United Nations Cultural Organization, has decided to postpone for another 2 years the question of whether the PLO will be admitted. As Roger Morier reports from Paris, this is being seen as a victory for the United States.
The PLO has been applying to various UN agencies to upgrade its status from that of observer to that of full member state. Such a bid was deferred at the World Health Organization last spring, and today the UNESCO board came up with the same solution, recommending to its General Conference, which meets here next week, to deal with the issue in 1991. The the PLO observer at UNESCO says he's pleased with that, since he wants to avoid any confrontation. The United States, which quit UNESCO in 1984, had made it clear that if the PLO was admitted, it would mean the U.S. would never return to UNESCO. The U.S. observer here, though, also says that today's decision is part of the politicization of UNESCO, one of the reasons for American withdrawal. And he says politicization of UNESCO is not good for the agency, and it does not bode well for an eventual American return. For National Public Radio, this is Roger Morier in Paris.
Tropical storm Dan hit Manila and southern Luzon in the Philippines today. At least 18 people were killed, and tens of thousands of Filipinos were forced to flee their homes. It was the second killer storm to strike the Philippines in a week. Typhoon Angela killed at least 118 people on Friday when it swept across the northern tip of the main Luzon island. Air Force officials at Clark Air Base said the storm knocked out 80% of the electricity at the camp's housing area. I'm Bill Redland, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Armistead Maupin is a social satirist. His primary subject is love, gay, straight, and in between. His new novel, Sure of You, completes his six-volume saga, Tales of the City. Set in San Francisco, it chronicles life in the 70s and 80s, cruising bars, cruising supermarkets, lesbian separatist music festivals, house husbands, the new baby boom, promiscuous heterosexuals, alternate families, cult groups, talk show pop psychology, the gentrification of the Tenderloin, and AIDS. Maupin's novels evolved from his San Francisco newspaper serial, which he began in 1976. Armistead Maupin grew up in a politically conservative family in Raleigh, North Carolina. After he moved to San Francisco in 1971, he came out and became a gay activist. I asked him to read an excerpt from his new book, Sure of You.
This is a letter that Michael Tolliver, a gay man in San Francisco who's HIV positive, writes to his mother in Florida. It's a difficult letter for him to write, so he stops at various points throughout the letter and begins again. Dear Mama, when you were talking about Papa's headstone the other day, I noticed you mentioned there was room at the plot for the entire family. No, awkward, start again. Dear Mama, it was wonderful talking to you the other day. Thack says you and I should talk more, and I guess he's right, since it always makes me feel better. Stop lying and get to the point. Dear Mama, I'm glad we talked the other day. There was something you mentioned, though, that concerned me. You seemed to think that someday the whole family would be buried at the cemetery there. I know how you meant this, but frankly, the idea of Christian burial strikes me as unnecessary and a little ghoulish. Real subtle, Tolliver. Keep writing. You can change it later. I don't know how much time I have left, whether it's 2 years or 5 or 50, but I don't want to be taken back to Orlando when it's over. This is my home now, and I've asked Thack to make arrangements for my cremation here in San Francisco. This wouldn't be so important to me if I didn't believe in families just as much as you do. I have one of my own, and it means the world to me. If there are goodbyes to be said, I want them to be here, and I want Thack to be in charge. I hope you can understand. If you still want to do a memorial service in Orlando, assuming you can't come here, Thack can send you part of the ashes. I think you know I'd prefer not to have a preacher involved, but do whatever makes you feel comfortable. Just make sure he doesn't pray for my soul or ask the Lord's forgiveness or anything like that. Please don't get the wrong idea. I'm fine right now. I just wanted this to be out of the way so we don't have to think about it again. I'm not too worried about how you'll take it, since I know how much you like Thack. He sends his love, by the way, and promises to send pics of the new chairs as soon as we get them painted. I'll try to call more often. All my love, Michael. P.S., my friend Marianne Singleton, you met her once years ago, has a new syndicated morning talk show. It starts in March, so watch for it. She's a good friend of mine, and we're all really happy for her.
Armistead Maupin reading from his new book, which is the last book in the Tales of the City series. Have you watched a lot of people suffer through writing similar letters to their parents explaining that they didn't want funeral arrangements in their hometown, that they wanted their family, even if it wasn't an official marriage type of family, to be respected?
Yes, actually, this particular idea came directly from my lover, Terry, who's HIV positive and who had some of the same concerns. Michael jokes in the book that he doesn't want a funeral where they set him up in the living room next to the spinning wheel with the philodendron growing on it. And that's a very real concern for a lot of gay men, that they would be drawn back into a world that they are no longer part of after their deaths, and they want they're leaving this world to reflect their lives in the world.
So Terry wrote this kind of letter to his parents?
He's spoken to his parents and made it clear that he wants to stay in San Francisco. And actually, he came up with the idea of dividing the ashes, feeling, well, if they had to do something, then some of the ashes could be sent home. I should hasten to add that Terry's perfectly healthy, and we hope he's going to be around for a long time, but you can't help but think about these things when you're HIV positive, and you want them out of the way early so they're not of concern to you should you get sick.
Now, the character in your novel who writes the letter that you just read for us is at some point in the novel propositioned by a famous designer, a man who's a famous designer, but that this man has just been written about in all the big magazines because at the Betty Ford Center, he fell in love with someone who worked there. Now they're perfectly, you know, they're the happy couple in like the perfect feature story way of happy married life. And of course, he's in the closet. He's gay. And the character who wrote this letter, Michael, who is propositioned by him, is furious that he's not out, you know, that this designer isn't out. This seems to be like something that's important to you. Famous people, especially people in the world of entertainment, who stay in the closet.
Yes, it's enormous concern to me. I feel that one of the reasons that homophobia is still so rampant in America is that most Americans have no idea how many of their heroes are homosexual. So we have a terrible cycle here of deceit where we continue to lie to the public about who we are, and as a consequence, homophobia continues to rage. We've seen 50,000 people die now because of that kind of ignorance. So it's no longer an adequate to me to say this is a career consideration and this is something I'm allowed to do. Either homosexuality is okay or it isn't. We have to make up our minds how we feel about it. And if it's okay, then it should be as matter of fact as the color of our eyes or our hair or where we go to church.
Sure of You, your new novel is dedicated to the British actor Ian McKellen, who came out within the past few years. I forget exactly when it was, but I think he's one of the first or one of the few actors of his generation to come out.
Yes.
In England.
It was last year, and he came out essentially to fight Clause 28, an English law which was tacked on to a finance bill, actually, that said essentially that the government could withhold funds from anyone found to be promoting homosexuality, whatever that means. Ian saw that it could be interpreted to exclude, you know, some of the greatest plays in history, and grew very angry about it.
Why did you dedicate the book to him?
Well, Ian's been a friend for 6 or 7 years now. He came to San Francisco several years ago when he was doing his acting Shakespeare tour. And the first night we were together, he called me and my lover Terry and my best friend Steve Beery together and said, what do you think? Should I come out of the closet? I thought he was, he's a charming man, and I love him very much, and I thought he was asking me this because he knew that it was close to my heart, and I really didn't think that he was going to act on it because I'd never seen anyone else act on it. And he did, and says that his life has been changed dramatically. He feels as if he's taken charge of his life for the first time. He was worried that the tabloids were going to get a hold of him and do something terrible, and he learned a very valuable lesson, which is when you come out yourself, when you declare yourself, you are no longer susceptible to scandal in that way. It's not a scandal. It's a big ho-hum.
Did you give him any advice when you had that conversation?
I told him yes. I thought that it would change his life and that it would make a big difference to everybody and that I thought people, especially famous people, have a moral responsibility to be open about who they are.
Am I right in saying that you had canceled Rock Hudson also, that he should come out?
In 76.
Comparatively long time ago.
Yeah, a long time ago. I thought it would be possible for him at that point, be easier for him at that point, because he had already established himself. I mean, certainly by 76, he was a very rich man. He was no longer really playing romantic leads, although I'm not even sure that's an excuse. And I knew it would make a lot of difference to people. And I've always believed, because I think I myself am an example of it, if you take charge of it yourself, if you say, this is nothing I am ashamed of, this is who I am, then you force people into the position of accepting your version of things. And I knew that Rock Hudson could do that. I figured that he would be, I told him I could foresee a time that he would be on the cover of every American magazine because he was being honest about himself. Now, of course, that happened, but it happened very late and under very sad circumstances. But he did do it.
Now, you're in the opposite position of people who are well-known and in the closet because you've been out ever since you start, well, since before you started your writing career as a novelist and your writing career syndicating the stories that became the Tales of the City book. You're about to embark on a book tour. You're going to be traveling with your lover, Terry Anderson. What are some of the things that you have to confront on a book tour when you're both out, but you have to deal with hotel reservations and booking the tour, all the stuff, dealing with the publishers?
Well, for one thing, the hotel reservations require a special letter from the from each of the hotels we visit, because we've found over the years, almost unfailingly, when we request a double bed, or rather a queen or a king-sized bed in our hotel room, that someone on the other end, behind the desk at the hotel, sees that two men are staying in that room and change it to two twin beds or two double beds. They do this because they're used to getting protestations, I guess, from heterosexual men traveling together who don't want to sleep in the same bed. And as a consequence, we invariably have to add 30 or 45 minutes on to a visit to a hotel where they shift us, during which time they shift us to the proper kind of bed. So it's a very frustrating experience. Even when you're out, the world continues to presume that you're not.
One of the characters in your book says that he doesn't want to become a Hare Krishna to other gays. What does he mean by that?
Well, I guess that particular character, I guess Michael says it, means that he doesn't want to have to always be talking about it. I feel that frustration myself. Terry and I joke about what we refer to as gay 101. Constantly having to explain the same things over and over again, but when you put yourself out there and make it someone of cause, that you end up having to do it. And I'm not sorry. I'm glad I took it on, because it's something that caused me a great deal of pain when I was a teenager, and even later. And I don't want that to be the case for other people. I think that by being more direct and honest, that I can sort of fix it so we don't have to talk endlessly about this in the future. We can just all be people and love other people, and it doesn't, it's no longer an issue.
My guest is social satirist and gay activist Armistead Maupin. His latest novel is called Sure of You. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Armistead Maupin is my guest. Sure of You is the last and sixth book in your Tales of the City series. Why did you decide to end it, and is it any coincidence that it's also the end of the decade?
I think that is a coincidence. I think I'm just ready to end it. It feels right to me. I have other projects that I want to get on to, and I also felt that the characters had grown to a point that it seemed like an end of an era for them.
What happens to you as the creator of all these characters when you leave them after so many years?
It is kind of like raising children and sending them off into the world, because I do feel like they have a life of their own now, and it will be sort of odd, I imagine, 3 or 4 years from now to speculate as to what they might be doing when I'm not writing about them. I can't tell you yet. Maybe I'll go through terrible withdrawal symptoms. I did after the second book, actually, when I resolved to stop it after the second book. I had a dream in which Mrs. Madrigal, the landlady, came into my room and sat on the edge of the bed and sort of shook my foot and said, "So you're leaving us, huh?" And I began to realize to what degree these people were so much a part of my life. The books really have served as a kind of shrink for me, I think, because each of the characters is a fragment of my personality. I lean on different sides of my personality when writing about them. So if they've matured or not matured over the years, those are really comments on where I've gone in those ways.
But can we talk a little bit about how your life has changed since the series began? You started writing these stories in 1976?
Right. Technically, in 1974, I ran some of the chapters in a Marin publication called The Pacific Sun. Marianne Singleton started out in 1974.
How long had you been in San Francisco then?
3 years.
And what started you writing these things?
I was writing nonfiction, actually. I went to the Marina Safeway in an effort to write a nonfiction feature story on the straight cruising scene that occurred at that grocery store. And I couldn't get any of the men or women who were there done up to the nines with, you know, three items in their grocery cart to admit to me that they were there to pick up somebody of the opposite sex. So I went back and made up Marianne Singleton and thought that an ironic end to the story would be that she would find the man that she liked and he would turn out to be there with another man. And the editors liked the idea so much that they said, "Why don't you keep writing it? Take them somewhere else next week and let's see what happens to them." And the story just kind of grew from there. And the characters began interacting with each other in ways that I had never dreamed.
I'm gonna ask you about this since you've been kind of chronicling life in San Francisco through the books. How has nightlife changed in the gay community in the past few years?
Well, I'm kind of the wrong guy to ask that because I'm a stodgy old 45-year-old now with a husband of 4 years.
And, so this has nothing to do with writing anyways.
And we really don't go out. One night we felt really guilty about the fact that we weren't going out. He's in the booth there laughing at you, I can tell.
He's in the control room laughing. Yeah.
And but we went out to a place called the Rawhide 2 one night, which is very popular right now. It's a kind of country western place that I write about in Sure View. And it was charming. I was really completely delighted because it was a total mix of people, gay and straight and lesbian and all ages. And the book, I say, it looked like the commuters on a BART train had suddenly begun to dance with each other. And it was a delightful San Francisco phenomenon, which I wouldn't mind doing again. I couldn't tell you about the rest. They have things called boy clubs now that are sort of young, you know, 25-ish gay male dance clubs where the patrons pride themselves on being antibody negative. But I don't go there for obvious reasons.
You know, you mentioned this place, the Rawhide 2, and that reminds me, once in Manhattan, I was waiting to get into a jazz club, and it wasn't time yet. And I was just walking around, and I needed a pair of boots. And I see this place called the Rawhide, and I thought, I bet they have nice boots. And I went in there, and of course, it's like lots of men with drinks in their hands.
Right.
Boy, have I come to the wrong place. I was wondering if you ever saw someone like me walk in at the wrong time.
Well, the Rawhide 2, you'd have no problem. I mean, I can't imagine who would be out of place at the Rawhide 2. In fact, there's a 70-year-old woman in Sure View who's there leading the dancing. That's one of the things that I've noticed, that because a lot of mothers especially came out to San Francisco to be with their sons when AIDS struck, and because those sons have yet to die, you find that there are a lot of these parents who are actually involved in the gay community in San Francisco and having a ball, having more fun than their sons who are, you know, probably kind of think of these festivities as being old hat.
I wonder what effect you've had on your parents, who I think your father especially, and forgive me because I'm not sure that they're living, but I know that he had been, or still is, I don't know, very, very conservative.
Very, yes, he is still living. My mother died about 10 years ago. My father is a conservative lawyer, living in Raleigh, North Carolina. His law firm is the law firm that runs the Congressional Club, the money-raising arm of Jesse Helms and the New Right. When my mother died, Jesse Helms read a eulogy to her on the floor of the Senate. They're that close. So I have a very difficult time still in communicating with my father on any political issue. We love each other, and I know that he loves me, and he knows I love him, but he's in his 70s, and he's not going to change, and I'm certainly not going to change. So we go round from time to time. I went back to Raleigh 2 years ago to participate, a year ago, I guess, to participate in Raleigh's first gay pride march, and we led a march of several thousand people down the main street to the Capitol building, past the monument that was erected by my great-grandmother to the Confederate soldiers of the city. And I made a speech on the steps of the Capitol during which I, you know, condemned Jesse Helms and the whole homophobic structure of that city. And it was a very odd experience for me to come home, to come back to that place and feel good about myself, because I had suffered so much as a child over what I was, and to realize after many years that you did that for no reason. You did that because of ignorance and because other people didn't tell you that you were all right. It's an amazing discovery to make.
I guess I'm curious to hear why you think your father hasn't changed at all, in the sense that if he's working for things that are very anti-gay, if no one else, he's got you as an example. Shouldn't he be thinking that maybe it's time to rethink his views on this?
I think he might have. I don't know. Part of my problem is I have a stepmother who's my age who is more homophobic than he is.
Really?
And I think that she's had some effect on him in that way. I'm not sure. He's able to deal with me and love me personally. He actually loves Terry, I think. I mean, the times that he's come out to visit, he's shown real affection towards Terry and sort of kidded him about how he thought Terry was the best thing that had happened to me. But it's on the broader... He's not willing to defend me, I guess is what he's saying. Not really to stand up for it. He's not willing to turn to Jesse Helms and say, "You're full of crap." And I think he knows on some level that Jesse is, but he doesn't know how to fight that battle yet. And if anything, he gave me a kind of toughness. I can fight it. I don't mind. I mean, I can make all the noise that he can't make at this point. But he comes from a generation that may not change. I had an editor tell me once that at the Chronicle, who said, "Your problems aren't going to be over until my generation is dead." Well, that used to sound kind of hopeful to me. All we had to do is wait for them to die out, but there are 20-year-old homophobes out there today. And the situation won't change at all until people make a noise about it.
Armistead Maupin, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Armistead Maupin's new book, Sure of You, is published by Harper & Row. It's the final book in his series, Tales of the City. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, my guest will be TV writer and producer William Link. He's co-created 14 TV series, including Columbo, Mannix, and Murder, She Wrote, and he co-wrote many made-for-TV movies. He's now the executive producer of the ABC Saturday Mystery Movie. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Tracking down a small accounting error in a university-based computer system put Clifford Stoll on the trail of an international computer spy ring. Coming up, Stoll tells us how he became a computer detective. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a never-before-recorded opera by Kurt Weill. He wrote it before he began his celebrated collaboration with Bertolt Brecht. And books your nearest chain bookstore don't stock are only a phone call away. Critic Maureen Corrigan reviews The Reader's Catalog, a new source book of over 40,000 recommended books. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The circumstances in which a Syrian pilot landed his Soviet-made MiG-23 fighter jet in northern Israel remains unclear. Israeli officials say that the pilot defected, but the Syrians say that his plane developed engine trouble and he was forced to land. Gerald Budd of the BBC has more from Jerusalem.
The Syrians, for their part, said that one MiG had made an emergency landing in Israel after developing engine trouble. The Syrians have demanded that the pilot be returned immediately with the help of the International Red Cross. Israeli officials say that if the plane had been in real trouble, the pilot would surely have bailed out, leaving the plane to crash, thus denying Israel access to the sophisticated gadgetry of the enemy MiG. As it is, the arrival of the plane is a huge prize for the military authorities here. For while the MiG-23 has been in service for many years, the Israelis have never had the chance to examine the electronics supplied by the Russians for this advanced model in service with Israel's enemy number one.
Gerald Budd of the BBC. The Bush administration notified Congress today of a $3 billion weapons sale to Saudi Arabia. The key items are 315 American tanks. While Arab arm sales generally raise concerns on Capitol Hill, this one apparently faces no problems. Barry Schwide filed this report from the State Department.
The deal goes through unless both the Senate and the House vote to kill it within 50 days. Pro-Israel lobbyists are not making a fuss, nor are Israel's most ardent supporters in Congress. Some of the tanks could be deployed within 120 miles of the Israeli border. The tanks will be delivered beginning in the mid-1990s, just about the time they're introduced by the American Army. Americans will train the Saudis how to operate the tanks, which are replacing virtually inoperable 15-year-old French tanks. The U.S. also will provide ammunition and support equipment, including special viewers so the tanks can be effective at night. The only significant restriction is that the tanks will not have special uranium plating, which is harder to penetrate than steel. Next year, the Saudis are expected to come back with a request to purchase U.S. jet fighter planes. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
At Cape Canaveral, engineers are working on a faulty computer that has delayed Thursday's shuttle launch for at least 4 days. This delay came after a judge cleared the way for liftoff by rejecting arguments from environmentalists that the nuclear-powered space probe is not safe. NASA says the liftoff of Atlantis could occur as early as Tuesday. A farmer harvesting corn near Alta, Iowa, has found the engine part believed to contain important information related to the crash of a United Airlines jet last July. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down almost 12 points to close at 2,773.36. There was moderate trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. A new production of Kurt Weill's Threepenny Opera, starring Sting and Maureen McGovern, just completed a run at the National Theater in Washington, D.C., and will open on Broadway early next month. But not all Weill works are as popular. The first recording of Weill's one-act opera, The Tsar Has His Photograph Taken, has just been released on the German Capriccio label. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review.
Kurt Weill's most celebrated works are his collaborations with playwright Bertolt Brecht, works like Threepenny Opera and The Rise and Fall of the City of Mahagoni. They are devastating satires on the political, economic, and moral climate of Germany in the late 20s. Some famous songs come from these shows, The Ballad of Mack the Knife, the Alabama Song and Surabaya Johnny, songs that mock both sentimentality and cynicism with their nasty lyrics and seductively pretty tunes. But Weill also wrote operas before he started to work with Brecht. For years, I've been curious about them, and one of them has finally been recorded. It's a one-act opera called Der Zar lässt sich fotografieren. The Tsar has his photograph taken. The libretto is by Georg Kaiser, another German playwright Weill occasionally collaborated with. Between its premiere in 1928 and the Nazi takeover of the theaters in 1933, it was one of the most popular stage works in Germany. It's a strange work. Weill and Kaiser called it an opera buffa, a comic opera, and it certainly has farcical elements. But its tone is more ominous. The story is about a czar who comes to Paris. He wants to have his picture taken by the fashionable photographer Madame Angèle. But before he arrives at her studio, freedom fighters who are plotting to assassinate him break in. One of the terrorists pretends to be Angèle. She plants a gun in the camera set to go off when the shutter is snapped. But the sentimental czar falls in love with this false Angèle and insists on taking her picture before she takes his. Understandably, she resists. After a series of farcical delays, the plot is uncovered. The false Angèle escapes, and the real but not so romantic Angèle finally takes the czar's picture. Weill's music for this opera is more conventionally operatic than in his works with Brecht. The tunes and harmonies aren't as abrasive or erotic. There are no excerptable songs or arias, but there are fascinating glimpses of the composer's later style. A male chorus, for example, supplies a running commentary on the action, and cheap dance tunes are already a Weill trademark. The assassins escape while a tango is playing on the phonograph.
Wo ist der Zar?
Dort unter Kissen.
Getötet.
Misslungen. Wir sind entdeckt. Wir müssen fliehen.
Wir müssen fliehen, die Zeit sperrt alle Straßen. Wir sind verloren, sie sind uns auf der Spur.
Sie sind uns auf der Spur. Leg die Verkleidung ab.
Es klopft.
Was ist das?
Was ist das? Was ist das?
Schon in aller Zeit. Schnell fort.
Schnell fort.
This excellent performance was originally broadcast in 1984 by the Cologne Radio Orchestra. The conductor is the gifted Jan Latham Koenig, who also conducted a major Weill recording that Capriccio issued last year, The Complete Mahagoni, starring the great dramatic soprano Agnes Silje. Capriccio is also planning such rare, previously unrecorded vile items as the Ballad of Magna Carta and the didactic radio play The Lindbergh Flight. Weill had urgent things to say to Europe between the world wars. His current popularity suggests that he also has things to tell us about ourselves.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a new recording of Kurt Weill's The Tsar Has His Photograph Taken on the Capriccio label. This is Fresh Air. Spying isn't what it used to be. Contemporary spies need neither cloak nor dagger when they're expert computer hackers. Clifford Stoll made front page news when he unveiled an international spy ring that had infiltrated military and government computers. Stoll is an astronomer who was managing the computer systems at a University of California lab that had government contracts when he discovered an accounting discrepancy. He found that 75 cents of computer time was unaccounted for. His investigation of this discrepancy concluded in the arrest of a West German spy who sold information to the KGB. Stoll's year-long detective work tracking the hacker is described in his new book, The Cuckoo's Egg. I asked him why a measly 75-cent error had bothered him.
To me, the interesting things in science are always way down in the noise. The big giant things that leap out and grab everyone else. No, I'm looking for the minor little noise. Little tiny things. And that 75-cent error was enough to open my eyebrows.
At what point did you call the FBI?
We called them the first day, and they said, "You're calling us up to tell us about a 75-cent error in your computer? Go away, kid! It's costing us more than 75 cents to even talk to you." So for months and months, they weren't interested. They wanted only major, big, million-dollar cases. And to us, we saw it as a case of espionage. They saw it as a minor 75-cent error in some scientific computer's operating system.
What made you think that the 75-cent error had anything to do with espionage?
At first, nothing. At first, I thought it was someone, some student, breaking in and having a good time fooling around. But then I started printing out everything this guy did. I started looking at everything this person took out of our computer, and we found that, no, he wasn't interested in astronomy and physics. He wanted to just take information from military computers. He'd connect into a military system and search for words on the stealth bomber, search for documents about nuclear preparedness in Central Europe. He'd search for information about strategic defense initiatives in Star Wars. Here's somebody who's just trying to get military secrets.
And how did you know what this person was searching for? How could you track them?
Every time he'd break into our computer, we had a printer that would print out whatever he did, whatever he saw. We were watching over his shoulder.
How did you know it was him? How could you identify?
We identified him from where he came from, by the networks that he used, but especially by the accounts and the passwords that he broke into our computer with. It was early on pretty clear that he would just pick certain people who were no longer at our laboratory, and he'd steal their accounts, steal their computer areas, and use those to break into other computers.
So you called the FBI the first day that you found the error. They weren't interested because it was such a small error, just 75 cents. You later called the CIA. They had a different reaction.
Yeah, this guy tried to break into the CIA. He searched for a pathway to get into the CIA. I called the CIA, and they said, "Hey, this is serious stuff. Don't move. Wait there. We'll fly three people out tomorrow." And so they, here I am in Berkeley, California, where all the long-haired radicals hang out. And the CIA flies three people in from Washington, and I gave them a chalk talk the next day, and their reaction was, "Hey, this is serious business. We've been talking about this happening, but we've never observed it before. We've thought that this might happen, that some spy might break into a computer. But This is the first real case that we have.
And you were the one who spotted that this computer spy was breaking into CIA files?
He wasn't breaking into the CIA. No, you can't get there because the CIA's computers are completely isolated. You can't get there. Rather, this guy tried to. He was searching for ways to get in, and we detected it, told the CIA about it, and they took it seriously.
Were you uncomfortable about working with the CIA?
Uncomfortable? I'm a long-haired hippie from Berkeley. I'm an astronomer. I have no security clearances. I'm, indeed, uncomfortable. One of my problems is that some of my lefty friends have essentially disowned me for dealing with these secret agencies.
Were they uncomfortable working with you?
Uncomfortable? Yes. They like people who wear ties. They like people who have security clearances. They like people who work under contract to them. They like people who share the same politics as they do. And instead, here I found a commonality that went beyond politics, where here is an outsider, genuinely an adversary, breaking in, stealing information to sell to the Soviet KGB.
So what you felt you shared with the CIA was vulnerability.
Yes, yes. What I shared with them is literally what's in the book, that here are the ways that this computer hacker broke into our computer, broke into these other computers. Here are the ways that almost any outsider can extract sensitive information. And at the same time, here are the ways to protect this information. To me, it was at first a mystery of how is this guy breaking in? After a while, my suspense was, who is this person? Where is this guy coming from? Eventually, I began to ask myself, well, what does this mean about, I guess, national policy? What about national secrets that are stored inside of computers? How well should they be protected? And I've worried and thought about it, and I'm delighted that it's somebody else's problem because I'm heading back to astronomy.
Now, one of the things you did was that you rigged your computer at Berkeley so that it would beep when the hacker signed on, and that way you were able to read over his shoulder. Eventually, you set up a fake file. Can you explain why you set up a fake file and how you set it up? What was in it?
We were getting almost no support from the FBI. Nobody was telling us what to do, how to do, and the beeper that I'd wear would sound off every time this hacker broke into my computer so he could start a phone trace. But the guy was smart. He'd only log in for 5-10 minutes at a time, steal something, and disappear. Wasn't on long enough for us to complete a telephone trace literally halfway around the world. What I had to do was create some completely false information. Enough information so it'll take him an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours to copy it all back to Europe. So we did that. We created, reams and reams of bogus, false, fake classified information. It was phony stuff about SDI Network, a Star Wars project. Just gobbledygook, a figment of my imagination. Put it all in our computer, and sure enough, the next day, 2 days later, or 3 days later, this hacker comes into our computer and starts copying all of this stuff out back to his system in Germany. And during that time, we're able to complete a trace, found out who was doing it, who was breaking in. 3 months later, a letter arrives in the mail addressed to one of the fictitious secretaries mentioned in one of these bogus documents. Letter says, hey, please send us more information about this SDI network that you have up in Berkeley. Please send us more information about this document, that document, and send us copies of these things. At that point, it was suddenly clear that this information wasn't just going to Hanover, Germany, because the letter was postmarked Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. At this point, the FBI no longer saw it as a 75-cent problem, but as a serious case of espionage.
So now that you know who the hacker was, tell us who he was and what his motivations were.
5 people were arrested in Germany in charges of espionage. They're going on trial in about 3 weeks or a month. The person that we followed was a 26-year-old computer programmer who has about 5 or 10 years' experience in programming systems. Apparently, these people were breaking into military computers, copying the stuff down, getting the printouts and selling them to the Soviet KGB, the Soviet spy organization in East Berlin, to the tune of $20,000, $30,000 a year, and then using that money to buy other computer equipment to break into still more computers.
Well, now that you have helped crack this ring of hackers, of computer spies, have you come up with any ideas about how to make computers less vulnerable to computer spies?
At least a part of the problem is that none of the computers that this guy broke into were secured very well. It seems that the people running the computers bury the keys to the computer under the doormat. They pick passwords that are weak, that are guessable.
I'm not going to ask you to give away the passwords that you're using in your computers, but what makes a password good?
The person cracking passwords doesn't sit there at a typewriter and type them in one by one, guessing them. No, this person will program a computer to scan all of the words in a dictionary, 100,000, 200,000 word dictionaries. It'll just write a program that says, hey, computer, sit there and try every possible password in the dictionary, and sooner or later you'll guess them. So any password like hummingbird or buzzard, hey, poor passwords. Instead, find words that you can't spell, like misspell a word, or misspell someone's name, or spell a word sideways, or put two words next to one another that have no meaning. In other words, don't pick anything that might show up in a dictionary. Don't pick passwords that are on the tip of somebody else's tongue. Pick things that actually look strange or are strange, because no computer program will be able to search for it in a dictionary.
Do you consider yourself out of the computer spy business now?
I wish I were. Oh, I wish I were. I'm trying desperately to get back into astronomy, but every time a new virus shows up, I feel it's fun to understand what happened, and I'll sit down and do a little programming and try to understand what it is. So, in a sense, it's a sideline, but I'd sure prefer it if there were no more. I'd much prefer to be back in astronomy.
Well, Clifford Stoll, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Many, many thanks.
Clifford Stoll's new book, The Cuckoo's Egg, is published by Doubleday. Stoll is now building X-ray astronomy databases at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with Linda Wertheimer. Linda, are you covering the Florida special session on abortion?
Yes, we are, Terry. The Florida State Legislature has taken a cue from the people of Florida, who said in polls that they didn't want their abortion laws changed. The Florida legislature has rejected all attempts to restrict access to abortion in that state. And on the federal level, the U.S. Congress has just put money back into appropriations bills for abortions for poor women. It's the first time in many years that those funds will be available. So it reflects all kinds of new things happening on the battle between the anti-abortion forces and the abortion rights forces.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. A few years ago, Jason Epstein came up with the idea for a reader's catalog, a way to order books that weren't necessarily in your local bookstore. Epstein is an executive at Random House and co-founder of the New York Review of Books. Now the reader's catalog has arrived, and it's as thick as a Manhattan phone book. Critic Maureen Corrigan sizes it up.
For months, local bookstore owners I know have been talking about the publication of the reader's catalog in much the same way as they might discuss a comeback tour by Salman Rushdie. You see, the catalog represents a revolutionary way of browsing for and buying books. The reader's catalog lists over 40,000 books in 208 subjects, everything from ancient Egyptian literature to pet care. Before the catalog, if you were interested in studying, say, modern architecture, you'd probably assemble a hit-and-miss reading list from the recommendations of friends, librarians, and booksellers. Now, the catalog can direct you to what it considers the important books in the field, as well as the best editions to read them in. But you can also order books through the catalog with an 800 number, and this is what's making bookstore owners nervous. They have visions of people cocooned in their homes, picking up the phone to order a pizza and the standard works on the Bauhaus movement. I don't think bookstores are in any danger. People who love books also love to fondle, sniff, and gauge the print size of the books they buy. The catalog's publisher, Jason Epstein, says he doesn't want to hurt bookstores. Instead, he wants to encourage them to maintain inventories that range beyond bestsellers. Epstein describes his project as an L.L. Bean catalog for books. But the reader's catalog has a way to go before it meets Bean's famous quality control standards. The catalog is maddeningly erratic. For instance, it recommends the best translation of Madame Bovary, but it doesn't offer any suggestions for the best editions of Chekhov or Dostoevsky. The catalog's explanations of modernism and structuralism are really sharp. But if you want to learn something about the philosopher Spinoza, here's what it says. The Dutch thinker Spinoza is a gigantic figure, but few readers know his work at first hand. It repays study. His beautifully designed systems of ethics and metaphysics are built on profound insights. I still don't know Spinoza's work firsthand, and obviously neither did the writer of this paragraph. The reader's catalog claims that the only reason it wouldn't include a worthy book is because it's out of print, but there are lots of baffling gaps. What happened to Lionel Trilling's landmark work of literary criticism, The Liberal Imagination, or Alasdair MacIntyre's listing under Recent Philosophy? I think the biggest problem with the reader's catalog is that it doesn't explain its criteria for selection. The catalog is the product of the intellectual tastes of its contributors, who include Gloria Steinem, New York Review of Books staff members, and Epstein's kids, but none of its introductions or blurbs are signed. Instead, like the canon of great books, the reader's catalog presents its recommended reading lists as though they're mystically self-evident. With revision, the reader's catalog could be a reference source as indispensable as the dictionary, though like the dictionary, it will always need updating. Right now, the catalog is a charming but irritating blend of arrogance and lazy erudition. It's sort of like having William F. Buckley perched slyly on your coffee table.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Amy Salad and Phyllis Myers produced the interviews on Fresh Air. Research assistance from Sue Spolin. Audrey Voblaitis directed our show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, William Link talks about creating such TV series as Murder, She Wrote and Columbo. And travel writer Jan Morris talks about her travels around the world and about her more personal journey from man to woman after a sex change operation. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.